And welcome back to your extended news at noon. Tracy Morgan, of course, in with you. All right, so first of all, I'm going to open this show up like I'm going to open it up tomorrow. And if you listen to me tomorrow, I'm going to talk to the Hospital and Healthcare Association of PA. And tomorrow, I'll say it today too, I'm going to talk about the pink elephant in the room for just a moment before we dive deep into what we're talking about today. On the phone with me is Dr. John Love, the infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. And yes, we're going to talk COVID today, Omicron and Delta and just where we are right now. So Dr. Love, I'll welcome you into the program because I'll get on my soapbox in a minute, but thank you so much for being back.
I'm happy to be back, Tracy. Sorry it's still necessary.
Well, and this is my soapbox for the moment. And I guess just what I want to talk about for just a brief second, because I recognize, as a lot of people do, that a lot of people have just checked out of this conversation, and I get it. Now, I know it's my job to ask you these questions. I know it's my job to get the information across to the public, but I can't thank you enough for your time and these discussions. I have actually found myself as a professional over the past 2 years feeling so assured because of our conversations, and then new information comes, and then I feel like I'm back in a pool of confusion. And I'm thinking, what does that mean now, right? Information is constant, it's confusing, we're all tired, you all are tired as well. We hear such a busy world out there on the national scene. And I can't tell you how comforting it is that we have you, the local voice, being so straightforward and easy to understand. I've said before to you, I know you don't have a crystal ball, I get it, but there are things that you have said along this path that eventually come true, as in, if we don't follow mitigation efforts, we're going to have new variants. Well, guess where we are? You know, it's things like that, that it has brought reason, at least in my mind, to what has been happening. And I hope it's a compliment to you. It's not meant to put you up on a pedestal, but it's just to relay that your voice is important. It's an educated voice. It's a well-informed voice. And I don't know if I've ever told you this before. I'll say it publicly. You're the reason I got vaccinated. You are the reason I got vaccinated. That you are an important voice to us in this community. So I will say again, thank you very much for being here and thank you for your time.
Thanks, Tracy. I appreciate that.
We could go in many, many directions, but let's try to just focus on the new variant. We'll talk about Delta. We'll talk about where the hospital is right now. And again, folks, my conversation tomorrow will be with the Hospital and Healthcare Association of PA. And we're going to be talking more in that conversation, not with Dr. Love, but they look at a state view because they deal with the entire state. Because isn't this going to be a trickle-down effect, in your opinion, Dr. Love? No matter if we're talking just Butler Health System, of course, we have UPMC in our area, Allegheny Health Network. I mean, we have so many other networks in our area, and of course, Pittsburgh with Western Pennsylvania, that even if a hospital struggles, doesn't that trickle down to the healthcare system in the state, let alone in the country, because we can't just go across the state lines and things are better there?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the resounding struggles that we have faced is this isn't something that is like a mass casualty event where it's a local event and we're the only ones impacted and we can reach out for assistance or resources from other neighboring or regional or state hospitals or health systems that aren't directly affected. You know, this is affecting everyone. It's stretching everyone. Everyone is struggling for the same resources, and resources often means medical staff, testing, and treatments. We are all under the gun together, and there's no one to help us except ourselves, and we're all kind of in the same boat.
Can we talk first about the number of deaths at the hospital? This is something that I'm not sure if people are comprehending this. We have reported over and over, of course, the information that comes from the hospital. I've said that many times before. And even if you're looking at a day, even in this month, you lost at least four people in a day. If you're talking a month, you know, we're looking at 20 in a month and 31 in a month. And I'm just going back through my notebook that I've kept every single report that you've given to us. I don't think people understand that many deaths in a day, let alone a week, let alone a month, is not typical. It is not normal for the Butler Health System, is it?
No,
for anything, let alone COVID, just anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's not. And, you know, when people say, you know, this is no worse than the flu, we've never had, you know, winters of the flu where we have four people dying in a day or 12 people dying over a weekend. Our staff has never had to deal with death at this rate. These are often patients who are here for some period of time before they die. So these are patients that the staff knows, gets to know. These are patients whose family the staff is talking with for often several, a couple of weeks while they're here. And so there is a real sense of pain with that patient's death, a real sense of loss and sympathy for the patient's family. And then, frankly, that patient's bed is filled with another sick COVID patient, almost immediately, and they have to get back to the task at hand of trying to nurse and nurture these patients through their illness and hope that this is one of the ones that gets better.
And Dr. Love, I know we're talking to you today on December 16th, but I have not yet seen the numbers today. So I will just remind people with the information that we've had just this month, 21 individuals have passed away. So just let it sink in at some point that the numbers that we talk about are just not normal. They're just not normal. And so I guess it's a bit of a frustration to me when we put out those numbers and folks just automatically turn to, well, how about many deaths from, X illness or whatever such a condition. These numbers are not normal, period.
No, not in these abbreviated periods of time. I mean, will we have people die from heart failure over a year? Certainly. Will we have people die from cancer over a year? Certainly. Will we have people die of sepsis? Definitely. But that's, those are not from individual single causes, multiple times during the same nursing shift. And the other thing to keep in mind, especially with this Delta wave, these patients are younger. I mean, these are working age people. These are people with kids that are still in school. This is tough because we as a society tend to value the lives of, say, nursing home residents maybe a little less than we do the lives of a father of, a family of four or five who's still working full time. I'm going to leave the ethics of that for another discussion another day, but that's as a society we tend to. We are seeing these young, otherwise, not completely healthy individuals, but talking people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Who may be overweight and may have diabetes, and that's it. And they are fighting for their lives in our ICU with this. And that's not normal. It's a loss for our communities. It's a loss for these families. It's a stream of loss.
Dr. Love, you mentioned Delta. I want to talk about Delta, but I know I would be remiss if I don't talk about Omicron first, because it seems like Omicron is the thing in the news right now. Is that of concern or not? And this is part of the frustration and the tiredness is that you hear so many reports. But as you have said before, science develops, things will change. So where are we with Omicron?
You almost have to talk about Omicron and Delta together. I think it kind of makes more sense. We are still currently very much in our Delta wave or surge or swamp, I think is probably the best word I could use for it at the moment. We had, our peak numbers a couple of weeks ago in terms of inpatients. The Monday after Thanksgiving, we had 74, I think, COVID positive inpatients at Butler Memorial alone. That number has since gone down, but we're still hovering around 50. We've been between 50 and 55 basically since then. And it's just a lot of patients that are occupying our beds and our staff resources. Even with the number of deaths that we just talked about, the number's not falling because they're just unfortunate passings are just being replaced with additional patients. So that's just what Delta has been doing to us. Omicron, let me take a step back, apologize. The CDC, nationally, over 99% of isolated virus that the CDC sequenced was Delta until very recently. Omicron is this latest variant of concern. It makes up currently about 3%, at last number I saw, 3% of sequences in the United States. There are other countries in the world that have been fighting this a little bit longer already. Remember, this variant was only identified just like right around Thanksgiving. So, when I say recently, we're talking a matter of weeks. One of the reasons that this Omicron variant is such a concern is that it has a large number of mutations or changes in the spike protein. Now, we've talked about the spike protein before. The spike protein is the protein on the surface of the virus that the virus uses to enter our cells.
And if we picture it, it's that picture of that ball with all the spikes on the end, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So it's got this little knobby thing, and it interacts with a protein on our cell surfaces, and it, you know, that interaction then it brings the virus into the cell.
Okay.
And so this is a very common mechanism for a lot of different viruses to use. They have something on their surface that interacts with something on our surfaces, and that's how it gets into our cells. The spike protein is what we get vaccinated against. So whether you get the J&J vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine, you are getting your immune system is being trained to recognize the spike protein so that you have antibodies that will block that interaction between the spike protein and your host and your own cells so it can't enter. Okay. There are other immune cells that also get trained, but in terms of preventing that initial interaction and internalization, the neutralizing antibodies are the key for that part of it. The spike protein is also the target for our monoclonal antibody therapies. So these are drugs like the Regeneron antibodies that people who aren't in the hospital yet, people who have mild or moderate symptoms, we give them these antibodies in the hopes of keeping them from progressing to the point where they need hospitalization. So both our vaccines and these monoclonal antibodies both target the spike protein. So if the Omicron variant has a lot of changes in its spike protein, the first question that comes up is, will our vaccine and will our monoclonal antibodies still recognize the Omicron variant? Because if they don't, then Omicron will do what's called immune evasion or immune escape, a vaccine escape. And the immunization is no longer protective because it is too different from what you got vaccinated against. That's one of the reasons that Omicron, the sequence of Omicron became such a concern, especially as they saw a pretty rapid propagation of this virus in South Africa and really carving out a very heavy niche really quickly. So this seems to be much more transmissible as well. The data that's coming out of both South Africa and the UK and some other locations is concerning that our immunity to Omicron from vaccination or previous infection is going to be lower than against Delta. There are a couple of points I want to make with this. First of all, previous vaccination, if you got only two doses of Pfizer or Moderna, you seem to be at higher risk of getting Omicron than if you get a third dose. So that third dose seems to be really important at protecting you against Omicron. And so this is where a real push for boosters has to come now. If you haven't gotten your third dose, please go get it now. Now is the time to get it so your immune system is ready for this. The data out of the UK is really striking. I think after two doses of these vaccines, they're only 30 to 40% effective against Omicron. If you get a booster, you're back up to 70 to 80%. So the booster is really the key right now. People who've had previous infections with COVID, you know, a lot of them say, well, I don't need to get vaccinated because I had COVID before and my immune system will keep me protected if I see a different variant in the future. Unfortunately, the data from South Africa is showing that people who've had COVID before, they're 3 to 9 times more likely to get reinfected with Omicron than they were to get reinfected with Delta. So the changes in Omicron are really impacting the ability of your previous infection and your immunity from that, from keeping you safe from this. So if you've had COVID before and you have not been vaccinated, I would urge you to go get vaccinated. I think that's the best advice that we can give anyone right now while we're still having this data come in. But the preliminary data says full vaccination, including booster, is the most protective that we can get.
Someone had mentioned to me that, again, what they heard out there is that it's more effective to switch, we'll say, companies. Like if you went Pfizer to then get Moderna, or J&J to go to Pfizer. Is that true or not? Is it okay just to stay with the same brand or company that you got your first and or second vaccine from?
Yeah, I think there is data saying that mixing and matching is okay. There's certainly not a recommendation that you should. The closest thing that I would say to a should would be if you got a first dose of J&J or one dose of J&J and you're ready for the booster, which for J&J is basically everyone 2 months after that dose, I would consider getting an mRNA vaccine for my booster. The data from there really suggests that an mRNA vaccine after a first dose of J&J is really generates a lot of immune protection. Keep in mind, a lot of these studies aren't looking at clinical cases. They're not looking at, do these people who mix and match, do they get better protection? Do they have lower infection rates? They're looking at things like antibody levels in the blood, which is great, but we don't have a really good handle on what a protective level is. So just because a mix and match may give you more antibody levels or a higher antibody level, does that really translate into better protection or not, I think is still unclear. So there's no problem with mixing and matching. There's no problem with staying the same. I got Pfizer for my primary series, my first two doses. I got a primer or a booster with Pfizer as well, in part because it's what I had, you know, really, really ready access to right here. I wouldn't have had a problem if my choice had been Moderna. I would have been fine taking the Moderna instead. Like I said, I think mixing and matching, you know, has some potential benefits. And again, after a J&J, an mRNA booster may make sense.
We've talked about demographics before in the way of age. Does weight have any play when it comes to COVID? Recently, I'll tell you that I went to my PCP just for that regular checkup, and the comment was, you should go ahead and get your booster because of the weight. It kind of shocked me a little bit because I thought, okay, I know I have a couple of extra pounds on me, but I didn't realize weight had any role in COVID.
Yeah, unfortunately, it really has become one of the clearest risk factors for severe disease, especially in our local population, our local experience. You don't need to be morbidly obese. Just being overweight is enough to put your risk up, makes it, you know, a little bit higher. We don't know exactly what the pathophysiology or the reason for this is yet. It has definitely been observed nationally as well as locally. It's one of the reasons why just having a BMI of a certain level has been a indication for getting monoclonal antibodies if you get infected. Or back when they were only giving boosters to certain people or certain populations, you know, a weight-based approach was one of the things the CDC carved out. You know, so I think it's hard. It's a obviously it's at some level it's a modifiable risk factor. It's not a rapidly modifiable risk factor, meaning it's nothing that you can change overnight for yourself, unfortunately.
Right.
But, you know, I do think that people, you know, they may think, oh, I don't have a chronic lung disease. I don't have heart disease. I'm not high risk. You know, if you're walking around, you know, with a BMI of 30, your risk is already up for having a severe infection if you get infected. And so those are people that we want to encourage vaccination and boosters. We want to encourage risk mitigation in other ways, you know, masking and distancing and just making, you know, smart choices about risk acceptance. But yeah, it is definitely a risk factor.
And folks, if you're just joining us, of course, this is Dr. John Love, the infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. Of course, we're talking about where we are right now with the pandemic. And I have one more question before I ask just a couple of questions about the hospital and where we are right now. The COVID pill, what is this and does it work?
So that's a really, really good question. The COVID pill is, you know, the one that is currently under deliberation by the Food and Drug Administration. Molnupiravir is from Merck. It is a medication. It's an oral pill, which is something that we don't really have for COVID right now as an outpatient. So the target of this drug is to treat people who have mild or moderate illness. These are people who are still at home, people who are still, haven't come to the hospital, haven't come to the emergency room, but are symptomatic and have COVID. And the goal of this pill is very similar to the goal of the monoclonal antibody infusions, which is to try to prevent progression of the disease to severe illness and to keep people out of the hospital, keep people from, you know, getting worse. The advisory board of the FDA reviewed this medication and the associated data a couple of weeks ago. They had a very narrow vote of only 13 to 10 to approve or suggest approving the emergency use authorization. So that, you know, they recommended it very narrowly by their vote. The FDA has taken this committee's recommendation and is reviewing the data further. So we are seeing information come out in the last couple of days from the news. The FDA is saying they are probably going to say this medication should not be given to pregnant women if they authorize it. There's just not enough data to say that it works in pregnant women. And there are some animal models to say that the medication may impact, I think it's cartilage and bone development in fetuses if, you know, given to the mother. That's unfortunate because pregnant women are very high risk of severe illness and complications if they get COVID. So that's really hard to learn that. I don't know which way the FDA is going to go on this. The more they look at the data, the efficacy of this keeps going down. You know, it had originally come out with like well over 50%, you know, reducing hospitalization risk by well over 50%. Then it was about 50%. Now it's like 30%. And it's like, is this pill worth it? Is this doing something that's meaningful if the efficacy is that low? Or is there a subpopulation? Are there specific patients that should be targeted with this that would benefit the most from it, and the efficacy would be better and get a better bang for our buck?
And I hear that you're saying the efficacy seems to be going down on it. But when we hear, I'm just going to say from my point of view, when I hear pill, I think of something like Tylenol, where you take a pill and like within an hour or two, you see the effects. What is the overall goal of this pill? Is it to, again, keep you out of the hospital? Is it supposed to prevent? Is it supposed to take it away? Like, what is the goal of the pill?
It's supposed to keep you out of the hospital and maybe, speed your recovery by a day. It's, you know, if you've ever taken Tamiflu for influenza, it's kind of like that. We're trying to inhibit further viral replication. We're trying to prevent further, you know, more of your cells getting infected, trying to get you kind of around the corner so you're, you know, on your road to recovery a little bit faster. This is not going to be like, I took a pill and I feel great. This may or may not really make a difference. And this is why the studies really are important, because different people recover from COVID in different periods of time. And it's really hard to say a drug improved your recovery. You know, if you got better in 5 days, well, would you have gotten better in 5 days without the drug? Possibly. I don't know. You may have.
Yeah.
Other people do.
And that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I think a lot of us, when we hear there's a pill out there, and again, it's not approved, as you just mentioned, but if we hear a pill, some people may think, well, I'll just wait for the pill and it'll be fine.
And here's the hard part. So this pill has to be taken within 5 days of the start of your symptoms. And so what's the normal course of events? Okay, someone feels a little sick for a couple of days before they contact their doctor. You know, then they get tested. It may take a day or two for the test to come back. You're at day 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, is this really meaningful? Is this can this be really rolled out in an appropriate and logistically, you know, feasible way to the population that really needs it? Or is this going to be better off if, say, dispensed to, say, nursing homes where they have on-site testing and they have at-risk, you know, where this may be the most focused way to approach it.
Yeah. I know a lot of people just want a magic pill, so basically it's not a magic pill.
This is not a magic pill.
Yeah.
This is, I would be more than happy to have another option. I just, even if this gets authorized, where this fits in, I think it still remains to be seen.
Yeah. All right. So let's ask you a couple of questions about the hospital and I'll let you go. I know you're busy. Let's first talk about what you're seeing at the hospital. Recently, it was not the hospital that was saying this. It was somewhere else in the country. I was just watching a newscast. And the individual was talking about their figure of 88% of what they're seeing is unvaccinated. But that means 22% of that individual's scenario would have been vaccinated people. So what are you seeing? Are you seeing still the majority unvaccinated, vaccinated? Are people getting reinfected, vaccinated, but without the booster? What are you seeing?
So I would say the majority are unvaccinated. Of the vaccinated, the vast majority, I'm talking like over 90% of people who are hospitalized with COVID who had been vaccinated, over 90% of those did not get a booster or were immunocompromised and never got the third dose of their primary series. Remember, people who have moderate or severe immunocompromise, they should be getting three doses of a vaccine instead of like the usual two, just up front. Before you talk about any booster, they get three doses up front, and then they get a booster in 6 months. So they would get a fourth dose. So when we look at the people that get admitted who are vaccinated, the vast majority of them are more than 6 months since their second dose and are in an area where we know we have waning immunity. This is why the boosters were authorized, is for exactly these patients. And so a lot of people will point to that, you know, see, there's a bunch of vaccinated people who are still admitted. It's not doing anything. I think that's the wrong approach. That's not how I view it at all. We got months of benefit from this. This is a known issue with, you know, getting 6 months out from that second dose or not getting an appropriate third dose if immunocompromised. And, you know, this is how the immune system works. And we have lots of vaccines that are multi-doses over long periods of time. It doesn't surprise me that two doses 3 weeks apart isn't enough to give you long, you know, permanent immunity. I wish that were the case, but it's not surprising at all to anyone that that's not the case. When I look at the number, yes, so our local would reflect the national. The vast majority are unvaccinated. Those that are vaccinated and admitted with COVID are not what I would call up to date on their COVID vaccination.
And this has changed over time and medicine changes. I'll keep repeating what you have said just to keep that in the minds of people. And I think that for folks who know people or had family members that were vaccinated, got reinfected and were in the hospital, maybe somebody has passed away. It's a hard conversation because don't you have to look at each individual's health, age, demographics, background in order to help understand why they were vaccinated, reinfected, and still passed?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of these vaccines, these aren't reinfections, these are their first infections. But we try to understand this, and this is kind of where the reminder to people, like, we got to get boosters in people. We are seeing in our own clinical care the implications, or, you know, we're seeing the data that says why the booster is important. We have to translate that into not just reacting for the patients who are admitted, getting the message out to our outpatients, to our clinics, to our other providers. Listen, we got to get these patients vaccinated or boosted again. We got to, you know, make sure that we get that message out so that people are aware of this risk, because the messaging, you know, last year when these vaccines came out, or last spring, you know, when a lot of the general population was getting their first doses, you know, was really like, this is going to solve everything. You know, I think we were a little Pollyanna-ish with our messaging and our language. And we had these 98% efficacy, and that's, oh my gosh, that's awesome, and it is awesome. But we didn't say just as loudly, but this may change. This may require further dose. Like, there was always, you know, like, I think we focus too much on the good news, which is great, but I think we need to revisit that and say, listen, I know, and it's worked really well for you, and we need to give you another dose so it keeps working as well for you, and we have to get that message out to folks.
Last area I want to ask you about is the hospital capacity, especially when we're talking about flu at the same time. How are you with capacity? Is the hospital at capacity, and where is capacity for the hospital?
You know, so capacity is... I don't even know how to define capacity anymore. Capacity is the volume that we can accept to do what we have to do. That's the bottom line. We have definitely, over the course of this Delta mess, have had to postpone surgeries for non-emergent situations. Patients that would have to be admitted after their surgery, if that surgery was not, you know, immediately necessary to save life or limb, you know, we've had to postpone some of these surgeries. And that's because we don't have either the beds or probably more accurately, the nursing staff to take care of the extra patients. And so this is a day by day, oftentimes a multiple times a day review by our OR staff and our nursing leadership. Can we proceed on schedule? Can we do everything that we have on schedule? Can we give all of the care that we intend to give and we think is necessary? Or do we have to compromise? Do we have to say, this has to wait? COVID patients can't wait, unfortunately. They need oxygen. They need care. And so these non-urgent patients often end up having a delay in their care. And non-urgent isn't elective. We're not talking, and we don't do plastic surgery here at Butler. These are patients who need joint replacements. These are patients who may need a colectomy because they have some kind of mass and they're awaiting a diagnosis. These are patients who are pending valve surgeries on their hearts. I think when I say non-emergent, I don't want that to mean these aren't medically necessary. These are all horribly medically necessary. And every one of these COVID admissions runs the risk of pushing out or delaying the care for one of these other people in the community because of the bed they are occupying.
Last year, when I talked to you, last December, a full year ago, we were talking about the plan B. If you had to go and expand room, then you all were working on plan B. Where we are right now, is it just as bad as it was then? Or I don't want to say is this better because we're still doing the same thing. We're still talking about the same issues. But back then, everything was still closed. Now things are open. So are you still in the same position as you're describing as possibly holding back surgeries and important procedures for people because of the space?
Yeah, I mean, we're still faced with the same challenges. And we still have a large number of admissions, and we still have a large number of, you know, just drains on our resources. Our staffing has remained adequate, but we're stretched. There's no other way to put it. We have had to hold patients in our emergency room because we don't have beds upstairs for them yet. It's not how we want to our hospital to function, but it's what we have to do to provide the care that is absolutely, you know, essential, right, that moment. So if that means, you know, we have to push off or delay or defer these procedures that we think can wait, then we're going to have to do that to take care of the acutely ill and life-threatening illnesses.
Last question. I want to make sure that I get this in before we do run out of time. But last year, we weren't talking much about the flu because when we did talk about it, you didn't see many cases. So, I mean, flat out, we have mentioned it before in the air. Folks don't think that we did, but we have talked about it before between you and me and also Dr. Rottinghouse and I, whenever we would speak. But this year seems to be a little different. Are you seeing flu cases and how is that wrapping into the care of the hospital or people coming into the hospital with flu?
We're seeing a handful. And the PA Department of Health tracks these, and this is a kind of a good way to look at it. And I've been looking at these numbers just this morning. And statewide, we are seeing an early increase in flu cases. You know, last week we saw almost zero flu at a state or even local level. This year, you know, the rise has already started, and you know the slope is going up. You know, I will remind people that, you know, this is a great opportunity to get their flu shot if they have not. I don't want people to not get a flu shot because they got the COVID shot and you can get them both on the same day, even at the same time. Okay. Just, you need both of these because both of these things are likely going to be circulated in our community through the kind of winter respiratory virus season. So yeah, I'm worried we are going to see some influenza on top of COVID this winter. We are working on our testing algorithms right now, you know, getting those rolled out, you know, making sure that we're detecting this when we need to. But this, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get away with the flu-free winter like we did last year. I think we're going to see influenza this winter because we're already seeing some now. The question is how high is that peak going to go? And as the Omicron variant makes its way into our community, is this going to be kind of one on top of the other? And what is this all going to look like when we get to look back at this in retrospect, you know, I don't know. But yeah, there's just a lot of variables right now.
Well, Dr. John Love, infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. Again, thank you so much for your time that you took with us today and keeping us up to date. I'm sure we'll talk to you again as things continue to progress. But again, always thank you for your time.
Thanks, Tracy. I appreciate it.